done a lot to measure and look at the effects of toxic substances in products throughout the marketplace. And I'm very happy to have Wendy Cleland Hamnett, who is in charge of the Office of Toxic Substances at EPA. And I'll give brief intro bios of them as they take their turn. And I have Mike Walls, who's a vice president and general counsel for the American Chemistry Council. So it seems like every day brings another report in the news about toxic chemicals of one kind or another in various products, whether it's baby bottles, sports bottles, shower curtains, dish detergents. And just this week, a couple days ago, the government of Canada, through the Health Canada division, decided to declare bisphenol A toxic substance. And this is on the heels of many states taking actions in this regard. And the European Union has its REACH law, which is an effort to comprehensively look at toxic chemicals in all of the European countries. And the chemicals of concern, which Wendy will tell you about, there are so many of them. There are something like 62,000 that were grandfathered when TSCA was enacted in 1976 and passed into law in 1977, but there are more than 80,000 of them in commerce. So there are many reasons why we are looking at these, because this law has not been looked at or changed since that time. And in the course of all these years, there have been efforts to restrict some of these chemicals, such as asbestos, which is a suspected carcinogen, and there were appeals by the industry to take asbestos off the market in certain products, and that did not work. So a lot of people have questions about how you're able to regulate these chemicals. So we're going to get a great introduction to the politics of this issue. Environmental advocates are arguing that these chemicals haven't been tested, require very few standards, safety standards, or even really basic information, and whereas drugs and pharmaceuticals do require pre-market testing, you don't have the same thing for these chemicals. Meantime, the chemical industry has said it also wants to reform TSCA to some extent, but it has different views on how to do that, that environmental working group. And in the meantime, the EPA has made some very strong statements regarding reforming TSCA, and EPA Administrator Lisa Jackson began her tenure as administrator saying that this is going to be one of her top priorities. So with that, I would like to introduce Ken Cook, and then I will just individually introduce. Ken Cook is president and co-founder of the Washington, D.C.-based Environmental Working Group, which is a public interest and research organization looking at environmental policy regarding toxic chemicals. And he is a frequent commentator on these things, and their organization has published many documents looking at the toxic chemistry of products. So I'm so happy that you're here, Ken, and I would like for you to tell a bit more about what Environmental Working Group has done with testing products, and for example, your Skin Deep program, which is excellent. So. Okay.
Well, Francesca asked me to start off with 5 minutes, so I'm going to go very quickly and hope we can have a great discussion. It's an honor to be here on this panel with my colleagues. We've been on panels before, and it's I always learn something from them. There are lots of ways to start a discussion like this, but let me start with the way the Environmental Working Group kind of started some years ago. The story is told in a book by two Canadian advocates for the environment called Slow Death by Rubber Duck, that how the Environmental Working Group decided to start testing not air, which we had done, and not water and food and products and other things, but how we decided that it would make sense to test people. We've been studying pollution in air, water, land, consumer products for decades, but there hadn't been very much done to look at the chemicals that ended up in people. So we have, to date, done a dozen studies, biomonitoring studies, as they're referred to, and have found in some 200 people we've tested, 493 different toxic chemicals, breakdown products, constituents of pesticides banned long ago, PCBs, dioxins, on and on and on. It's all on our website. In 2006, we released our first study of toxic chemical contamination of newborns, the chemicals that were detected through a very expensive study in umbilical cord blood, which we obtained from the American Red Cross. That was 287 out of the 413 that we tested for in umbilical cord blood. And then again in 2009, we tested 10 minority babies, African American, Hispanic, and Asian American. And we found 232 chemicals in their blood. In some cases, it varied, but for the most part, you found hundreds of chemicals in each one of these newborns, dozens and dozens of carcinogens, dozens of chemicals known to interrupt endocrine system, hormone systems of various kinds, dozens and dozens of neurotoxins, and on and on. In many cases, data were not available that would tell us very much about these chemicals at the levels we found them alone, and there were no data available on the potential effects of the combinations of these chemicals. And some of the chemicals were not just neurotoxic, but were carcinogenic, and not just carcinogenic, but it interfered with the hormone system. So there isn't anyone in this room who doesn't now have hundreds of toxic chemicals in them. Or if you've had a child, no one has been born without hundreds of those chemicals in them. And we really don't know very much at all about the most rudimentary questions you would ask. And that has really opens the door to why this has come about. And one reason we're finding hundreds of chemicals in babies and we're seeing chemicals on the front page of newspapers from time to time and various stories, including just this past week, as Francesca said, BPA, is because of the 1976 Toxic Substances Control Act, the only major environmental law that has never been revisited and seriously reauthorized. It's been fiddled with, but not in its body, not the part that regulates industrial chemicals. Pesticides are a different story. We can talk about that. That is a very robust, comparatively robust, regulatory system with a very strong safety standard, but not we don't have that for industrial chemicals. Here's the problem with the law, and in a nutshell, and I'm going here in a kind of an unusual order. I'm not going to tell you what's wrong with the law so much as tell you what's been proposed in Congress to fix it. And when you hear what they feel they need to do at this point to fix a law that's been on the books for 30 years, many reporters who haven't been working in this field are sort of stunned to find it out. They're going to require that chemicals that have been in commerce and on the EPA inventory and new chemicals, they're going to require a pretty significant list of health and safety studies that must be conducted for all of those chemicals. So that's not required now. They're going to require the agency to use that information to prioritize which chemicals we should be worried about if this law comes to pass. They're going to make the information public. Health and safety studies, by and large, under the Toxic Substances Control Act, unlike the pesticides law, not public. They're going to require expedited action to reduce risk. They are going to require that all chemicals meet a safety standard, and there's a big debate about what that standard should be. The bills introduced so far have adopted the pesticide standard and also a standard in food and drug law, but that's a major debate Mike and I have all the time. They are suggesting that we, dictating that we reverse the burden of proof so that the industry will have to demonstrate the safety of the chemicals instead of the opposite, which is now the case, where the agency must demonstrate harm in order to take regulatory action. The burdens for taking, the difficulty of taking regulatory action, even asking for a study, usually requires a rulemaking just to get data. So quickly to the outlook. So that's what we're looking at, a huge undertaking. The outlook, I think we're going to be looking at more and more evidence, scientific evidence, that will link chemicals to risk, if not to harm, to public health. We'll see more and more chemicals under fire, and products that they're in, I think more of them will be rejected by consumers. I think if you were to sum up the problem of Tosca with from industry standpoint, I think it's fair to say it's that because we don't have a stronger law, the public has lost a lot of faith in the safety of the chemicals that are used. And then just one final point. I think we did miss an important window in the last Congress to take the Tosca reform effort to the next level. Sorry to say. I hope that window reopens soon, but the fact of the matter is we had an opening and weren't able to take advantage of it as we might have, and we're going to have to see what next year brings.
Thank you.
That was 7 minutes.
Well, you have a couple more minutes if you want to tell us more about what are the toxic properties of bisphenol A, for example.
Well, bisphenol A is, there was just a wonderful piece by Brian Walsh wrote in Time magazine on BPA. BPA has been shown to have all kinds of disturbing properties, but mostly it's at very low levels, disrupts, interferes with hormone systems. I'll just read you a brief statement from the Endocrine Society, the leading association of scientists worried about basically hormone researchers and medical specialists in 100 countries. They warned in 2009, in June, they issued a statement, even infinitesimally low levels of exposure to endocrine-disrupting chemicals, indeed any level of exposure at all, may cause endocrine or reproductive abnormalities, particularly if exposure occurs during a critical development window. And there's we could have a whole other panel on how science has driven this debate, the new science of toxic chemicals and epigenetics. But they go on to say, surprisingly, low doses may even exert more potent effects than higher doses. And the American Medical Association has adopted this same stance as of November of 2009. So, all of these chemicals, just because you find a chemical in someone, as we are always insisting on, just because you find a chemical in someone does not mean there's going to be a health effect. It doesn't mean if you have 100 carcinogens in you that those 100 carcinogens are going to lead you inevitably to get cancer, although one out of every two men in their lifetime in this country and one out of every three women will develop cancer, one out of eight breast cancer. We could go through all those numbers. But if those exposures are happening at the same time that this disease is taking such an incredible human toll and economic toll, we ought to have much better information than we now have about their safety.
Great, thanks. I think it's important to find out what exactly has gone on in the last 30 years in terms of the regulation of Tosca, and we'll find that out from Wendy Cohen-Hamnett. But now we're going to turn to Michael Walls, who is representing the main trade group for the toxic chemical industry, and it's the manufacturers and distributors And Mike Walls is Vice President of Regulatory and Technical Affairs for the American Chemistry Council. And this is the trade group that is representing companies engaged in the U.S. business of chemistry and chemical manufacture. It's a $675 billion enterprise employing 800,000 Americans. He represents the industry on a wide range of advocacy issues at the state, national, and international level. So Mike is quite a veteran at this topic, and we have public policies and regulations that seem to, according to Ken Cook and others, and even the industry itself, somewhat of a hands-off policy when it comes to how we look at these chemicals. Is this a good thing? It seems that Cal Dooley from ACC has said maybe we do need some reform. So I wanted to ask whether the industry is continuing to encourage the growing and faster volume acceleration of this of these chemicals, or is there somewhat of a retrenchment within the industry? So please tell us what.
Well, it's a thank you, Francesca. It's a pleasure to be here today. Well, I'd like to sort of start out focusing on some, just to relate our basic positions around modification of the Toxic Substances Control Act, then maybe address some of the points that Ken has raised. In our view, regardless of the likelihood of change in the congressional leadership, it's important that Congress get after modifications to TSCA. If there was any good news coming out of the last 18 months, is that the issue's been squarely placed on the radar screen in Congress, and we're starting to get a debate and a dialogue going around these issues. As Ken said, maybe from his perspective, a window of opportunity was missed, but I still think nonetheless it's an opportunity that will allow us to build on and to achieve a fundamentally sound public policy. What I want to make clear is that the American chemical industry is motivated to get TSCA reform done. It's fundamentally in our interest. Let me talk about why that's the case. There's really three major reasons. The first, it's an issue of safety. Clearly, the general public, the government in some cases, the chemical value chain may not have as much confidence in the safety of chemicals for their intended uses. We can do better on that. How would we do that? Well, with some of the approaches that Ken and I would agree on, at least at the 50,000 foot or maybe even 10,000 foot level, we need better data. EPA has got to have an ability to prioritize, to sort of distinguish what really needs additional action. They need to have the authority to make a safety determination on those chemicals to make sure that they're safe for those intended uses. They need to have the flexibility to adopt different risk management approaches depending on what's really called for in any particular circumstance. And we need to have a system that's a little more dynamic that allows us to account for and incorporate new developments in the technology, especially the science and technology of detection. For our part in the industry, we're supporting a great deal of research. We've got something called the Long Range Research Initiative that's putting money into better understanding the methodologies and the science behind exposure assessment and risk assessment. We did cooperatively with the Environmental Protection Agency, we had our high production volume program, which produced basic hazard data on the highest production volume chemicals out there in commerce. There's a kind of an interesting thing here. Even the description of this program today is somewhat misleading. Francesca's right. There's 80,000 chemicals on the TSCA inventory. But we know that not every one of them is in commerce. In fact, the last update of the inventory in 2006 showed a little less than 7,000 chemicals actually in commerce. Now, we need to do a better job of painting a picture of what exactly is in commerce, how it's moving in commerce, and how it's being used. But The fact of the matter is that the inventory is a historical database. Nothing drops off, but you have to be on the inventory in order to manufacture or import that substance. Second reason why TSCA reform needs to be accomplished is to protect innovation. Modifications to the statute are necessary to ensure that the U.S. business of chemistry continues to provide a leadership role in innovation, global leadership role in innovation. 1 out of 8 U.S. patents are now related to chemistry. That's an indicator of just how important this industry is in driving new innovations. The products that improve energy efficiency, for example, or that foster renewable energy, are all the products of chemistry, whether it's solar cells, that's basic chemistry, whether it's wind turbines from the polymers and the composites that make up those wind blades, to lightweighting vehicles. We did a study of a life cycle assessment across the industry with some of our colleagues in the international arena. And for every unit of greenhouse gas emissions from the chemical industry associated with the production of chemicals, the products of chemistry and their use help reduce or mitigate twice as much. With the right policies in place, like energy efficiency standards and building codes, for example, you could help drive the further penetration of some of those existing technologies and foster the beneficial uses of chemistry while you have a regulatory program that addresses health and environmental concerns as well. The reason we need to address the innovation component as well is to allow EPA to regain its global leadership role in chemical regulation. Personally, my view is that EPA has always had a significant global role in helping identify potential concerns and regulating appropriately. In some cases, in some international fora, the U.S. role is not as robust. We can do better. TSCA reform will help us achieve that. We also need, as I mentioned earlier, to foster those innovative new technologies that are emerging to assess chemicals faster and more accurately. We have some approaches that allow us to mechanistically determine whether or not a particular chemical has an effect at the cellular level. That technology exists, it's emerging, it's coming forward, it's going to be better in the near future. What we don't have is the technology to interpret the results. In other words, we can identify the impact at the cellular level, but what does it mean for the individual? And then from that, what does it mean for the population as a whole? And then from that, what does it mean for the development of regulatory policy? In addition, there's a serious issue here in terms of innovation, of fostering the best science, of bringing the best science forward. That's an issue of credibility for the industry. We want to rely on the best science. TSCA reform provides us an opportunity to outline some criteria by which all science, not just my science, I want Ken's science subject to the same sort of criteria that our industry is subject to, so that we can make sure we're bringing the best science forward on which to make decisions. Third major reason why we need reform is fundamentally jobs. Francesca mentioned we had 850,000 jobs in our industry. Each one of those jobs fosters 5 or 6 additional jobs in the downstream industries, in the use of chemicals. We're in a globally competitive industry. It's really a building block industry for the U.S. economy. 96% of all manufactured goods in the United States are touched at some point by chemistry. So the reason that also is important to address this jobs issue is that what we're seeing emerging, and as Ken mentioned, is the emergence of potentially different and conflicting state programs. That's not going to foster a uniform national market for chemicals. It's not going to foster a uniform regulatory system. And it could have consequences for the industry in terms of jobs. So in closing, chemicals, TSCA in particular, is a complex issue. I mean, we're talking about fundamentally effects on the human body where the science isn't perfect yet. In fact, the human body is nothing but chemistry in motion. I mean, there's a reason why doctors talk about blood chemistry. It's not just because, it's because in fact we are walking bags of chemicals. And it's very much on the frontiers of science. Now, you know, Europe took 8 years to get to a reform of its regulatory systems. They recognize the complex issues, the complex interactions here on how you develop a regulatory system that's protective of health and the environment and still fosters the industry. I'll just add one more point. You might want to consult factsaboutbpa.org. It's a website, industry-based website on BPA. I have a little different interpretation of what Canada just did than Ken does. We can get back to that later if there's questions. Thank you.
Ken ended up with one more minute, but
that's all right. I'll cede my minute.
Okay. Well, thanks so much, and I hope we can get into more about the extent to which the industry has grown, the chemical industry, and how many chemicals are out there, and you know, how it's grown over the last 10 years. I think that will be very interesting to find out too. So I'd like to turn now to our policymaker on the panel, who is Wendy Clellan Hamnett, who began her career at EPA in 1979. She's director of the Office of Pollution Prevention and Toxics, otherwise known as OPP OPPT. And that is in the Department of Prevention, Pesticides and Toxic Substances. And he's held a variety of jobs in OPPT, as well as the Office of Environmental Information and the Office of Policy. You can find all the bios online, but I thought it would be good to at least give you a little bit of a promo. And you've also worked in the Special Assistant in the Office of the Administrator in Pesticides and Toxics. So clearly you've had many, many years to look at these issues and the poise to be in a position to take action when and if Congress does something about this. So my question to you, does TSCA need reformation, as Lisa Jackson says, and how?
Absolutely.
If so, how?
It absolutely does. I actually started my career at EPA about 30 years ago, fresh out of law school, working in the TSCA program when it was a fairly new program in the early 80s, reviewing new chemicals as they were coming on the market. And I did that for a number of years and then went off and did other things in the agency, working in the policy office, the administrator's office, and came back to this program about 5 years ago, and then became the office director in January of 2009, which was a wonderful time to get that position, because there's a lot of opportunity and a lot that needs to be done. It's a very challenging program, I think, as you can appreciate from the presentations you've just heard. Ensuring the safety of chemicals, restoring public confidence in EPA's ability to protect the American public, reestablishing a leadership position for EPA in terms of global action on chemical safety and chemical management is one of the top priorities of Lisa Jackson. January 23rd, I think it was, of 2009, probably her first official day on the job, she issued her list of priorities. And chemical safety was right up there with clean air, clean water, energy, and climate. And that is the first time, frankly, that this program has seen that level of attention from the administrator of EPA. Very encouraging, very welcome among the career staff in the agency who work in this area. We have, and Lisa Jackson announced this a little over a year ago, in September of 2009, that we would basically be pursuing two tracks in terms of our work in chemical safety. The first would be working to reform the Toxic Substances Control Act, working with Congress and all of the stakeholders to improve our authorities to assure chemical safety. And the second track is, because that legislative process is uncertain, because it can take a period of time, we will also be we have been making a big push to do as much as we can administratively with the current statutory authority and resources we have to do as much as we possibly can to ensure the safety of chemicals. So we are fighting that war on two fronts, as it were. Why is this important? Both Ken and Mike have talked about why this is important. I work with people across the agency who work on the Clean Air Act in terms of controlling pollutants from stationary sources, from facilities, from cars, et cetera, with people in the water office who look at drinking water, chemicals in drinking water. They all do very important work, but what TSCA, or hopefully a new statute, allows us to do is to look at those chemicals before they get out there, before they're a concern in terms of emissions from facilities, before we're finding them in drinking water, before we're finding them in people, or understanding what the implications are when we're finding them out there. It really is a pollution prevention, or could be a pollution prevention program. And you do find chemicals everywhere in the products we use, in the materials that are used to build our homes, our children's schools, you name it. You know, as Mike said, chemistry touches almost everything we do. Problems with TSCA. Again, my colleagues have talked about these, but again, no mandatory program to determine the safety of chemicals that are out there in commerce. We do have a program to review new chemicals prior to their manufacture. There are some shortcomings with that program. Companies aren't required to give us any particular health and safety data when we review a new chemical. So we rely on looking at structural similarities. This is a gross oversimplification, but looking at structural similarities of chemicals that we do have data on, how they compare to the new chemicals. We've developed some fairly sophisticated tools over the years, but there's still some shortcomings with that new chemicals program. But compared to the existing chemicals program, it works fairly well. As Francesca noted, there were about 60,000 chemicals that were in commerce at the time TSCA was passed, and we established that initial inventory of chemicals. Over the last 30-plus years, over 20,000 chemicals have been added to that list, chemicals that have gone through that new chemicals program and been added to the inventory. As Mike said, we don't know exactly how many of those 80,000-plus chemicals are actually out there in commerce. We think it's probably more than 6,000 or 7,000. Those are the chemicals that we get some regular reporting on, but those are chemicals that are above a certain threshold of manufacture. And there are a lot of smaller volume chemicals, specialty chemicals that are produced that we don't get regular reporting on. That's one of the things that we would like to improve. TSCA also creates an exemption for small businesses under TSCA. So small businesses, even when we have a rule out that requires provision of information, they don't have to report. So we don't know how many small businesses are dealing with chemicals, where they are, what they're producing, and that sort of thing. We have some fairly difficult hurdles under the current version of TSCA in terms of taking regulatory action, particularly to manage risks from chemicals where we can demonstrate a risk. The burden is on EPA to demonstrate that a chemical presents an unreasonable risk. So we have to show toxicity, we have to develop the information to show that there's exposure, and then the unreasonable part of the unreasonable risk finding is we also have to look at costs and show that the benefits of reducing risk would outweigh the costs of reducing risks. Again, a simplified approach, but that's what that means. During the 80s, there was an effort to use those risk management provisions of TSCA to address a number of chemicals. There were five rules that were put in place when you think about 60,000 chemicals on the inventory. And again, Francesca mentioned asbestos. In the late 80s, there was an effort to ban the use of asbestos in a range of products using that provision of TSCA. That rule was overturned in the courts. And that decision placed, you know, depending, there are always discussions about, you know, how to interpret some of these federal court decisions, but a lot of people believe that that decision placed even some additional burdens on EPA in terms of making a case to regulate chemicals. So since that asbestos case about 20 years ago, that risk management provision of TSCA has not been applied. So for 20 years, we have not used that regulatory authority to reduce risks from chemicals. There have been a number of efforts to work with industry voluntarily, where industry has phased out chemicals when it's been clear that there's been a risk, and the agency has worked with industry on that, but we haven't used that regulatory authority in over 20 years. We also have hurdles in terms of requiring the development of toxicity data to require toxicity testing. Again, EPA has a burden to show that a chemical, we have to show that it may present a risk in order to get the toxicity information to evaluate whether it may present a risk or demonstrate that there's significant exposure, which also requires us to have information. And the rulemaking process takes a lot of time, cost to the agency in terms of trying to develop the information. So again, we've used that regulatory authority to require testing on about 200 chemicals out of the 60 to 80,000 or 50,000 or whatever might actually be out there in commerce. Mike mentioned the High Production Volume Challenge program. That was a program that was launched during the Clinton administration with industry and with EDF to get information submitted on the highest production volume chemicals, which is somewhere around 2,500 chemicals, over a million pounds a year of production. We did get a good amount of information in. The agency's still working through that information. There were a number of chemicals, however, where no industry stepped up to sponsor those chemicals and provide data. So we have been using that regulatory testing authority to try to get that test data from the companies who didn't step up. And we're still, you know, that challenge program was launched in 1999, I believe. We're still trying to work through the regulations to get all of those chemicals tested. And TSCA put some hurdles in front of us as well in terms of transparency and making information public. Ken mentioned this. Companies can claim the identity even when they can't claim an entire health and safety study confidential and keep us from releasing it, but they have had the ability to say the identity of the chemical is confidential. So, for example, there's a provision of TSCA that requires companies to submit information to us if they come into the possession of data that shows a chemical might present a substantial risk. And we put that information now up on the web. But we have these submissions, AD submissions they're called, where, you know, it'll basically say a chemical, you know, is known to cause reproductive, developmental, whatever effects, but we can't tell you what the chemical is that's causing those effects. Now, we're doing some things to address that. TSCA also doesn't allow us to share confidential business information with state governments who are addressing chemicals or with other national governments, our colleagues in Canada or the European Union or Japan. So that's also made it difficult for us to work with them and share information on chemicals. So those are some of the burdens that we have been facing. The bills that were introduced in the House and the Senate earlier this year would go a long way toward addressing some of those problems. The administration, again last September, put out principles for TSCA reform. That are available on our website, but basically say chemicals should be assessed against a risk-based safety standard. Manufacturers or importers of chemicals should have the responsibility to demonstrate that they meet that safety standard. That our assessment should take into account costs and the availability of alternatives and so forth, also take into account particular risk to children, to sensitive populations, populations that are disproportionately affected, there should be timelines and priorities for moving through chemicals so that we don't get, you know, caught in long do loops and arguments about the science and what it does and doesn't tell us, and that EPA should be adequately funded to do this, and that manufacturers through fees should bear some of the costs of that the government, that EPA incurs in order to do these things. What are we doing administratively? We have, and Lisa Jackson again announced this last September, have started a program to identify chemicals of concern, high priority chemicals that we know people are concerned about, where there's information available, and try to quickly move to take some action on those. So far this year, we've issued 8 action plans for a number of chemicals, so BPA, phthalates, the perfluorinated chemicals, some other chemicals, and that information is up on our website. And as part of those action plans, we're looking at regulatory action. We're looking at using that risk management regulatory authority that hasn't been used for 20 years. As challenging as that might be, we feel it's our responsibility to use that authority as best we can to require testing on some of these chemicals. We're using an authority under TSCA that hasn't been used in 30-plus years. It's to establish a chemicals of concern list. So we're hoping to have that proposed rule on a chemicals of concern list out later this year. We are adding chemicals to the toxic release inventory reporting so that information will be out there in the public. Not all of the phthalates are reported under TRI, some others of these chemicals, and so we're trying to get that information out there. We are developing several rules on nanomaterials that are based on chemicals that are on the TSCA inventory that would allow us to get information on what what nanomaterials are being developed, what they're being used for, what exposures are like, to require testing of some of those nanomaterials for health and environmental effects. So we're hoping that proposed nano rule will be out in January as well. Let's see if I'm forgetting anything. We recently proposed amendments to our inventory reporting. This is this inventory update rule to lower some of the reporting thresholds so that we'll get more information on more of the chemicals, to require more information be submitted to us on downstream uses of chemicals. This is an area we get reporting from manufacturers, but often we hear manufacturers don't have information on how their customers are using chemicals, what the uses are, and therefore what the exposure is going to be downstream, either downstream processing facilities or in consumer products. And we're particularly looking at information on children, how children might be exposed to chemicals. So, and the final piece, I'm probably running over time here, but we're also working on increasing transparency. We put out a policy earlier this year on that example that I talked about, the substantial risk reporting. It basically says you can't keep the chemical identity confidential in that instance. We've made the inventory of chemicals available without cost on the web for the first time in 30-plus years. We've taken chemicals that were confidential and added them to the public inventory. We've encouraged companies, and we're working with Mike and his companies on this, to go back and look at claims of confidentiality they've made in the past and where those claims are no longer valid, to release those so that we can put more information out to the public. So there's a lot that's going on in EPA. We're very, very much supportive of TSCA reform and working with the Congress and the stakeholders to continue to push for that. But we're also not waiting for that. There's a lot that we're trying to do under the current authorities as well, and we'll keep pushing on that until we get new chemicals legislation. So thanks for the opportunity to talk to all of you.
Thank you. Well, we're supposed to leave a solid half hour of question and answer, and the whole purpose of these panels is to go forth and multiply, create many, many wonderful stories, and there are so many possibilities here, because unless you're writing for the Environmental Law Journal about TSCA or you're a day of reporter, you know, more often it's going to be a feature story about particular products and all the different, you know, diseases and disorders that, you know, some of these chemicals have been linked to. What I would like to just start off the questions by asking, both of our panelists have talked about the window of opportunity presented by TSCA reform and all the, you know, the incredible public interest, the polling data showing that the American public is really interested in having some reform here. And both Ken Cook and Mike Walls have said that their organizations would like to do this, but why is it that if both the industry and the environmental groups want to reform TSCA, why is it that it did not go forward? I mean, I read in Politics Daily yesterday that there was actually a good deal of pushback by the industry of TSCA. But so I would like to ask all the panelists why, you know, TSCA reform is, you know, some seems to be stalled given great public interest, polling data, rash of media stories on every possible product. Not even to mention the electronics. You know, because it's not just, you know, everyday household products. We're talking about a multiplicity of electronics that we are, in the United States, is the foremost buyer of cosmetics, personal products, electronics, you know, sports accessories, et cetera. So, you know, it's all out there. So why did we not grab this window? What happened?
I'm going to defer to Ken.
Well, you know, there's... I also read that story, and look, I mean, we had a conference in September of 2009 that we, as we started the planning, we called our colleagues at the American Chemistry Council, because we thought this, at that point there hadn't been enough of direct discussion in a public venue to kind of find out beyond below the principal level what were the fights going to be about. What were the areas of agreement? And Lisa Jackson came and keynoted it. Cal Dooley, Mike's boss, was there also. We had the head of the Grocery Manufacturers Association. We just had a lot of leading scientists from around the country. We split up the panel so there were two industry people and two people from the, you know, sort of public interest side. And it was, I thought it was really terrific. But the problem really was a couple of things. One, we had Congress busy with other things. Henry Waxman's committee, just for starters, had a couple little items to take care of, like health care and climate change. So they were busy. And climate change then, of course, also on the Senate side, even though that bill that went to the same committee of jurisdiction. We had made the case, the Environmental Working Group had made the case, that we ought to reintroduce the KidSafe Chemicals Act in early 2009, so that at least we'd have something to talk to staff about and have some principles that we could point to, even if knowing the bill would change. But, you know, that was not the decision that was made. And we didn't actually have a bill until March of 2010.
A discussion draft
in the case of the House and the Senate. Mm-hmm. And that was a loss of a lot of time. We went to every single office on both committees of jurisdiction, all 50-plus members of Energy and Commerce, and I can't remember how many exactly in Environment and Public Works on the Senate side. And there was tremendous interest on both sides of the aisle, tremendous curiosity about what approach should be taken. I think Cal's leadership in striking out a posture that the industry was going to try and embrace modernization was really important. And we've given them credit all along for doing that. It was a change in posture, a change in direction, and we salute it. But we just didn't get the legislation drafted in time to be able to say to an office, and every single office said this to us, that's great, that's interesting, risk based, reasonable, you know, a health based standard, all these principles, that's great. I need to see a bill. I can't go to my boss with a list of principles. And I can't go to my boss with the bill that was introduced last time until I know that it's going to look like the bill now. So just for that reason alone, it was very difficult to, you know, we had hearings. Those were helpful. We had lots of, you know, discussion back and forth. Staff from the House and Senate didn't even meet to discuss changes to the previous bill and steps forward until September of 2009. So this Congress, which, and I would put it this way, if you were to try and line up the constellation of interests and potential, you have an EPA administrator who's a chemical engineer. And not only that, doesn't talk about chemicals first, talks about kids. Great political hand. She is the first EPA administrator, I think, who has ever made TSCA reform a priority.
I think that's right.
And then you had a strong interest in Congress. We had overwhelming public support. I mean, our list goes crazy for these issues. We built our, you know, our online community around it. We had a tremendous coalition, Safer Chemicals Healthy Families, that developed, brought together hundreds and hundreds of organizations from everything from environmental justice groups, the faith community, scientific organizations, public interest, public health groups. They were pushing very hard. But we just, you know, we ran out of time. And now we've got a bill, a couple of bills out there that will form the basis for future discussion. But we're heading into a Congress where, you know, we've heard from a lot of our friends in on the industry side, you know, we'd like to wait for more Republicans. There are other ways to put it, but
what do you say to that?
He's not quoting ACC.
No, of course not. But you know, I think there are other factors there. I mean, there were some intramural spats within the environmental community about what the issue should look like. There were some spats within the chemical industry that kind of, you know, made it uncertain who wanted what. That was a factor too, but we just lost some time. So now we'll have to see what's next.
I'd just add very quickly, you didn't have First of all, I don't agree with the characterization in the Politics Today piece that somehow the industry was walking away. Expressing some concern about the detail that's necessary here is not walking away from the issue. We're still very much at the table. We're committed to getting this done. But what we didn't have over the course of the last 18 months, despite efforts to encourage it, was a real dialogue. We had an opportunity with the House staff to flag issues, to say, okay, this provision raises this issue, this issue, this issue. But there wasn't real opportunity to say, okay, here's how we ought to work it out in detail. And that's where the devil is in TSCA reform. If we get that opportunity, and I'm hopeful we're going to see an environment on the Hill where we can have that type of dialogue with our stakeholders, with EPA, with members of Congress, that we can actually get something done in the next 2 years.
Well, to clarify, it was Politics Daily, and they weren't saying that ACC walked away. The charge in the article was that the lobbying against the bill, the bills, which were actually not that different. The Senate and House bills were not
that
different. But that was the charge in that article. I'm not saying I agree with it. I'm just saying something for you reporters to look at. But I, you know, it's time for question and answers from the floor. And please identify yourself, and the reporters are given preference. So, Ty Trimble, Popular Mechanics.
I had a quick question that goes with what Michael was saying about scientific standards going across the board. I think this is important for us reporting. We can't wait for all the information to come into the EPA. So my two questions are, I mean, EWG and ACC both have a lot of data, not peer-reviewed much of the time. Should the burden of proof be on the EPA? And if not, what do you suggest would be another place, or should there be a fund? Should there be a separate? Should there be separate peer review? What other industry help?
A couple of comments in response. Yes, we think industry has a responsibility to bring forward the appropriate hazard use and exposure information that allows EPA to prioritize chemicals efficiently and effectively, and that allows EPA to get to a safety assessment. I think it's generally agreed in our communities that there's some level of screening data and information that can be usefully applied to prioritize chemicals. There's another level of additional detail, additional data that you might need to reach a conclusion of whether it's safe for a particular use or a particular exposure pattern. In our view and in our publicly stated positions, industry should have an increased burden, especially when it comes to some of the safety assessments. We are advocating for a government role in at least reviewing those assessments and that's where a lot of the confidence in the system comes out, will come from, is in EPA is making a determination that something is safe. I think with in terms of the data that's available that hasn't necessarily been peer-reviewed, there are well-accepted approaches, the weight-of-evidence approaches, that would allow EPA to sort of balance. It's not just a simple mathematical balance of there's 10 studies says there's an effect and there's 50 studies that says there isn't, or vice versa. It's a little more sophisticated than that. But there are methodologies out there for EPA to weigh the evidence and use that weight of the evidence approach in reaching its regulatory decisions.
I would just add, I mean, I think you ask a very good question. If you look at the way things are handled when a pesticide either comes to the agency for the first time or is examined for re-registration so it can remain on the market, you have a large set of studies because among other things, we know exposure is going to happen in many cases from these chemicals. That's the premise of the regulatory posture. There'll be environmental and human exposure. And there are protocols for the studies that are required by the agency to be followed. That's the bare minimum starting point, I think, for having scientific rigor, a structure so that you don't have one company doing a developmental reprotox study using one methodology and species of animals and dose levels and all the rest, and another company doing a different kind of study, and having the agency then try and figure out weight of evidence, it becomes almost impossible to do that. So just those basic things, if we had for toxic chemicals, I don't have a number of studies in my mind that should be required. I think that's another area for debate. But that's just for, you know, that makes sense. The pesticide program is funded in large measure by fees from the industry. That's made the pesticide program, I think, the largest employer in EPA. Is that
right?
That's right. And we would anticipate that there would be a very substantial increase in the scientific capability of the agency with TSCA reform. To do that very thing if there was a fee structure put in place, which I think in principle you...
Yeah, in principle we support a fee structure, but I think just to comment quickly on Ken's point, I think it's too easy to look to the pesticide and pharmaceutical regimes and say we ought to pick that up and put it in industrial chemicals, because there's major differences between industrial chemicals in those areas. First, pesticides and pharmaceuticals are intended to be biologically active. You know, on the one side, you're either trying to kill something, or you're trying to, you know, whether that's a cancerous cell in the body or a particular pest. You also have narrow ranges of exposures. You know, with the pesticide program looks in general at exposures created from food intake. It's the Food Quality Protection Act, actually. For industrial chemicals, you're looking at a much wider range of uses, a much wider range of exposure scenarios. Well, how do you go through that in an efficient and effective way? I think Ken's on the right track in the sense that you know we're going to identify what information you need to make a decision in any particular case, but it doesn't necessarily have to be the same information. We could have a minimum data set that actually varies according to use patterns, for example. Something that makes it a little more efficient and effective for EPA, but also something that allows EPA to focus in on where is the real exposure concern coming from. Let's posit that there are certain hazards, but if we focus on the exposure pattern that poses the most concern, presumptively, an EPA review in that area would help us give us some confidence that exposures contained from other uses would be safe as well. So there are ways of working through these problems.
I wanted to ask Wendy to speak to what Mike Laws just said about the use, the intended use, and you know, restricting it to that mere exposure. With the REACH law, I mean, they have looked at it from this standpoint. Can we learn from the way the European Union? Mm-hmm. I mean, they have adopted the precautionary principle in some cases, right? I mean, how could EPA adopt any of the guidelines that they have so far?
Well, we're actually spending a lot of time talking with our colleagues in the European Union to understand how they're doing things, where we can to take advantage of their lessons learned in implementing REACH. Clearly, a lot of information is being developed for the purposes of REACH that could also be useful to EPA, and so we're, you know, looking to get as much of that information as we can and use it. And to the extent that we can, you know, harmonize our approaches with their approaches or with, you know, Canada's approaches or those of other countries, I think it benefits all of us. You know, that being said, you know, we do have a somewhat different chemicals market in this country. Uses or exposures might be different here, so we need to be able to account for that as well. Now, one thing I would add to the last discussion in terms of, you know, I think having standards for the development of data would be very helpful. To get to the point on exposure, there are lots of areas where we don't have toxicity data. We really have a lot of issues with exposure data. And getting better information on exposure would be very, very important for us. I also think that transparency is very important. So there's clearly should be a role for EPA, even with the burden on the industry to show that they meet a safety standard, there's a role for EPA, just as there is in the pesticides world, for reviewing that and providing some consistency and oversight to those findings. But I also think that information should be publicly available. So all of you you know, anyone who's interested can look at that information, how the industry has analyzed it, how EPA has analyzed it, you know, and basically keep the sunshine on the process. So I think that's an important piece of this, too.
I think that is an important reference to reach. Again, I think its major benefit for us is probably going to be in the data development side. The vast majority of chemicals that are going to be registered under the under REACH won't be reviewed by any governmental agency. You know, the government agency is going to focus again on a narrower set of substances they call substances of very high concern. Those may have specific regulatory actions of a precautionary nature, but it's still too early to tell. The system's just being implemented.
Well, now you raised the issue of exposure, which really takes in exposures from many sources. Mm-hmm. So I did a story, for example, on phthalates and had to do with the IV tubes and how that might impact, you know, children, neonates. Mm-hmm. And I did a and they were also on the Centers for Disease Control's human exposure studies, where they found the phthalates were surprisingly high in women of reproductive age. And at first they thought it was what they call an artifact, meaning that in the testing equipment, mm-hmm. there might have been a higher rate of phthalates, mm-hmm. just, you know, in the plastic. And they, you know, ruled it out initially. Then they thought, well, you know, why is it that it's in women? Is it because they wear nail polish? Is it because, you know, they're using all these lotions and creams, or, you know? And so then it set them sort of off on this detective investigation into what could it be. So when we're talking about regulating, you know, this chemical, chemical A, chemical B, chemical C, you know, whose responsibility is it to look at, you know, the multiple, you know, how many, the multiple routes of exposure, and then, you know, is it just the baby or the infant when it's, you know, drinking from that sippy cup, or is it the mother when, you know, she's pregnant, or is it a year before she's pregnant, you know, when her body is, you know, changing, or is it the husband, you know, who is equally, you know, potentially exposed? So whose responsibility is that?
Well, you know, it's an interesting area of science, I think, that's under development. Both of the bills, if I remember correctly, talk about aggregate exposure, which is, you know, for a given chemical, what are all the various sources of exposure you might get and throughout your lifetime. And they also talk about cumulative exposure, which would be what's your exposure to a range of chemicals that, you know, for example, might have the same sort of effects or the same, you know, affect the same mechanisms, biological mechanisms. So phthalates, for example, there are a range of phthalates. Looked at individually, they have varying levels of toxicity. But if you look at a range of phthalates, what are the cumulative effects of being exposed to a number of phthalates, you may end up with a different risk picture than looking one by one. The National Academy of Sciences has put out reports in terms of toxicity for the 21st century. Cumulative risk is one of the areas that they've encouraged EPA and other federal agencies and the scientific community to look at. And EPA, actually, across the Office of Research and Development is leading this. Our office and other program offices are involved in terms of how will EPA be approaching cumulative risk in our risk assessments in the future. The pesticides program is already taking steps to look at that. Mm-hmm. So I think that it's a really important question.
It is a very important. Sorry, Ken, I didn't want to.
No, after you.
It is a very important question because, you know, this goes to some of the emerging science. The fact of the matter is that National Academy's study was referenced in both versions, both the House and Senate mm-hmm. versions of the bill. And while most of that report, I think, constitutes, there's a lot of consensus in the scientific community, there are two aspects of that report in particular where there just isn't that much agreement. One had to do with cumulative risk assessment. We have limited experience, even in the pesticide area, with cumulative assessments. The second was on this theory of a linear low dose or non-linear low dose theory. The notion that at infinitesimally small exposures, there's still nonetheless an effect. That's a theory that has yet to be taken up by the mainstream, or what I'd say the weight of the, or the body of science. There's some concerns out there. I think there's a lot of research underway, research that needs to continue. Goes to that point of, yeah, you can find a disturbance maybe from any chemical, even water, at a cellular level. But what does it mean? You know, does the body have a capacity to adapt to that? What are the exact effects, et cetera? So this is, again, very much on the frontiers of science. There's a lot of work in EPA and the National Institute of Environmental Health and Safety, for example, the national academies. Industry is supporting a lot of that work. And as we get this information, we understand not only how to develop the data, but how to interpret it, we'll be in a better position to make appropriate regulatory decisions.
Could I just add one thing?
Yeah.
But meanwhile, the exposures have all happened, right? So what we're hearing, and I agree with Mike's characterization of the Academy report, but is it completely far-fetched to think that if there are hundreds of carcinogens or neurotoxins in each of us, that there is absolutely no point or no way to try and figure out cumulatively what effect they might be having? And the answer right now is the government, except in a few instances, I think, in the pesticide program with OP pesticides, mm-hmm. insecticides, bug killers, we worked a lot on that in the 90s and did try and add up the risk from insecticides that had the same health effects. So this is another reason why I think people don't have as much faith in the government and the products as they might have, because we've put all of these things not just out into the environment, and one way to look at exposure is look at what's coming out of smokestacks and what you find in products and so forth, but we now know that it's in people, and we don't know much about how to interpret the magnitude of the health risk, but we know the exposures are there. We've urged the bill to be even more strongly oriented to get to the finish line quickly on exposure by doing more biomonitoring, including biomonitoring of umbilical cord blood and meconium, baby's first poop, I always feel like I need to add, and other types of material, so that we can understand just which chemicals pop up early on. Mm-hmm. If a chemical's in my, I've got a little 2-year-old, and he was on a, he had to, for a while, had to have a tube feeding, because he had some real serious problems in his first 9 months. Everything's fine. He's doing great now. The first thing I looked at when I got those bags that I had to hook him up to every night was, I wanted to see what they said about him. And the very first thing they said on the bag was phthalate-free. A lot of work had been done by Healthcare Without Harm and other advocacy organizations. We played some role in that as well, to say to the companies, look, if there's concerns about this, can you shift to something that's safer? So 2 points. One, I can't say that the material that replaced the phthalates in that bag is safer. I know it's not phthalates, just like it's not BPA and it's not this or not that. We need a law to establish a safety standard so that whatever they put in place of it is also safe, but we don't have that yet. And the second thing is, industry pushed back really hard back in the 90s and said, if we get rid of phthalates, we will not be able to have blood bags or IV bags or anything. No tubes. It just won't work. This is the material. We have to have it. They wrote it. They made ads about it. I think the American Chemistry Council still has an ad where all the chemical devices in the examining room disappear. If we got rid of plastics, maybe it's not your.
If only you were our intended audience.
That's right. So, but the fact is, we didn't have to get rid of all these things to move to something that at least was not a phthalate. We want to take the next step and see, well, what's in there is safer. But we didn't. It turned out have to have phthalates and everything in order to have IV bags.
Ken, that's an important point. I mean, from our perspective, first, children are a paramount issue. And, we've got to have a regulatory system that allows us to identify where those potential exposures are, and a system that allows us to assess assess their potential impacts. I mean, clearly, you know, parents have got to make decisions that are right for their children, you know, and part of doing that is to have an appropriate amount of information so that they can get there.
Any, we need a couple more questions? We still have a couple minutes. Yeah.
I go to Home Depot frequently, and one time I went in there and I noticed that one of the chemicals was offered as a bug balm or something. It had a little parenthetical expression, not California has ruled against using this, and for health reasons. And I've noticed since then that several other products say California does not allow this.
Yeah.
Are they just a bunch of organic hippies out there? Why does California not allow some things that we in Virginia can buy and use?
I think those are actually statements that warning, this product may contain a chemical considered by the state of California to be a carcinogen. It's on beer bottles.
Reproductive toxin,
thank you. It's on beer, it's on a whole lot of things. It doesn't necessarily prohibit the sale of that material in California. It's a warning system. The safe harbor requirement, that is your ability to not put that warning on your product, requires some intensive and very expensive testing at levels that really challenge, in some cases, the limits of detection. So you'll see a lot of products, because we have a national market, are not going to, you know, they're going to be sold here as well as in California, and so to comply, they'll put it both on. But it's not necessarily a decision by California to ban that substance or that product.
Okay, but
it's confusing, isn't it?
Well, if it says California considers this a carcinogen, why doesn't the EPA consider it a carcinogen?
They may. In fact, California's list of carcinogens, this was Prop 65 out in California. California's list is built in part on the federal government's list of carcinogens.
I should ask Wendy.
So we may have, the EPA may have assessed that chemical and decided it's a carcinogen. But again, because of some of the issues I talked about in terms of TSCA and regulatory authority and so forth, we have not been able to get to a point of labeling or otherwise, you know, addressing the risk from that chemical. And California has put into place its own green chemistry law, where they are looking at assessing chemicals and looking at safer alternatives. I think, at least in large part, because, you know, EPA hasn't been as active at the federal level in that playing field as I think states like California and some other states would like to see the federal government being. So, and I'll just say one of the things I think I neglected to mention when I was talking about the things that we're doing is that we're also launching a number of alternatives assessments for some of these priority chemicals. For BPA, we're looking at alternatives to BPA and thermal paper,
mm-hmm.
for example, that like cash register receipts and so forth.
Carbonless paper. Which I found BPA is in.
Right, and sometimes in surprisingly high amounts. Alternatives for some of the flame retardants, we're going to be doing an alternatives analysis for phthalates and some of the uses that EPA regulates as opposed to the FDA, you know, medical use thing. So we're trying to push the envelope that way. Also to say there are alternatives, and we then do a hazard assessment on those alternatives so that we can be in a better position to say these things are safer. But again, we're doing that, you know, on a small number of chemicals that we can address now as opposed to being able to do it more broadly.
I said at the beginning, I learned from these two every time I get a chance to hear them speak, but it is, for those who haven't been engaged with this process or these laws, some of it's pretty unbelievable what the agency is not able to do, what it doesn't know, what you would think would be known. And I think that's at root why we have a big trust gap that is starting to affect the, you know, state legislatures. I mean, I think you're going to see an explosion now over the next couple of years of not just state legislatures, but cities, municipalities, taking regulatory action to deal with specific chemicals and their uses. So it's really gotten kind of, it's gone on too long. I think we needed a more rigorous system some time ago, but this is what we have.
And I just add quickly that part of that trust issue comes from the fact that TSCA is not the only chemical regulatory statute out there. We've already alluded to the pharmaceutical and pesticide restrictions. There's about a dozen other federal laws that affect chemical manufacturing, distribution, use, disposal, all across the chain of commerce. So you don't have a single law controlling or regulating industrial chemicals as you might have in some other countries. So that's another factor. And another reason why we should be getting TSCA right.
But whereas, you know, some of these other statutes deal with the waste, you know, and it's disposed in a place, you know, where you might not be close to it. These are things that we're putting on our skins, that we're imbibing, that, you know, we're in contact with all the time. So understandably, there's been a lot of interest and concern. And to close this session, I just want to thank my panelists, and I'm so pleased that you all, you got the tip-top, you know, representatives on this issue from industry, government, and the environmental groups. And the only other environmental groups that are not represented here, there is a Safer Chemicals, Healthy Families Coalition, which is represented by, well, it's representing NRDC, EDF, a dozen or so. And I've put down...
Oh, it's really hundreds. Yeah, it's much bigger.
Hundreds of groups.
Yeah.
So of state groups and urban groups and...
Whole range of organizations.
We've also left a hard copy of our basic principles around TSCA reform here on the corner.
So you can pick those up. And I would also recommend that you look at a few books that have tackled this issue. One of them is Exposed, which looks at the differences between the way the European Union is regulating this and the way the United States is regulating this. And there are a number of other books that have come out in this regard, and these are just a few of the resources. So, and people can get back to me if anybody has questions. Francesca Lyman, chicha19@comcast.net. And I hope you'll get exchange cards, and thanks so much. Thank you for coming.